We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
12 voices in 12 hours. This is a special community discussion on opioid prevention on News Radio 930 WBEN.
Good morning. Our day-long conversation on the opioid epidemic is underway here on WBEN, and we're starting things off with Dr. Josh Lynch this morning. He's an emergency room physician, and he's also a member of the Erie County Opioid Task Force. Dr. Lynch, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks.
We appreciate it. You are right on the front line with this. What's the current situation here in Western New York now, and compare it to years past?
You know, I think that we're finally starting to see some slow progress, and at least progress with the numbers. You know, thankfully, we've actually started to see a decline in opioid deaths in and around Erie County. Thankfully, so where a lot of other parts of the country are actually seeing increases, we're starting to see kind of a gradual decrease. So I think that speaks to the volumes of work that not only just the Erie County Opioid Epidemic Task Force, but really everyone across our community is pitching in and working together.
And your involvement's kind of spread beyond just the task force now, right?
Right. So that's really kind of where I started. And I saw other opportunities to really try to get things done and make connections, really with the ultimate goal of getting people connected with treatment, which I think really was a huge obstacle. And thankfully, you know, today is not as big of an obstacle.
Well, the task force has been around for a couple of years, right? How has that helped the problem?
So the county legislator, Mark Poloncarz, decided that we need to get everybody in the same room that normally people that normally don't work together, and put them together and let them figure it out and let them try to work together to kind of accomplish some goals. And that's exactly kind of where this started. So you have now people working together like doctors and police officers and detectives and treatment counselors and public health people. And typically we wouldn't really be in the same meetings or in the same room. So we realized that we have a lot more in common. A lot of the barriers are kind of common to multi-disciplines. Like, I may have the same problems that a police officer has, and unless we sit in the same room and try to hash things out and work through things, nothing will ever get accomplished. And thankfully, Mark Poloncarz kind of realized that and is like, let's try to do this. And now, interestingly enough, he is on some national work groups where other parts of the country, normally that you wouldn't think of asking Buffalo for advice, have asked him and really the Erie County Task Force, kind of, how did you guys accomplish this stuff? So those kind of things are positive, that other parts of the country that we may consider experts at everything are reaching out back to us to see how we're doing stuff.
Or reaching out back to us because just about 5 years ago, I remember doing a story with experts who were saying that Erie County, Western New York, is one of the opiate capitals of the U.S. Is that still the case?
It certainly has been one of the higher concentrations of the opioid problem. I mean, unfortunately, there are a lot of condensed areas that have super high opioid abuse and opioid death rates, and Erie County, has been one of them. But I would expect the trend to continue to decline because we're not done working. And if we've made some progress already to watch that opioid death number, at least in Erie County, start to head down, I don't see why it wouldn't continue.
Has there been any, greater explanation in your mind as to why it hit Erie County, hit this Western New York area so hard in the first place?
Nothing specific really jumps out. However, we, as we've seen in the news over the years, we've had some pretty aggressive, inappropriate prescribers. And I think that with our law enforcement partners kind of cracking down on some of the inappropriate prescribing, I mean, we're talking about like multiple times what normal physicians should be writing or prescribing for opioid medications. And this is a perfect example of why we need the law enforcement partnership too, to make sure that, you know, everybody's doing the right thing.
Is it multi-pronged, though, the whole blame thing? Is it not just the doctors, but is it also the insurance companies? Is it the big pharmaceutical firms? You know, right. Can you go on and on like that?
Yeah, I as a physician, we're certainly on the hook for part of this, for sure. However, like you had mentioned, insurance companies with reimbursement and payment for certain types of medications could have shifted things that way. The drug companies, I think we've seen in the news now that some of the drug companies just totally came out there and when they were educating physicians years ago said opioids are not addictive, period. And I think now these guys are in some hot water for educating the prescribers that those facts really weren't true.
It's a national pushback kind of we've seen right. growing on that, right? It's
right.
Whether it's just the lawsuits or other things like that, not just here, but nationally, I think whether it's doctors or just everyday people are kind of aware that that was happening.
Yep, absolutely. And I think that we're seeing everybody really try to step up, right? So the court system is trying to step up against Big Pharma, which is never an easy task. The law enforcement are trying to think outside the box. Like there's a program around Western New York with a whole bunch of police agencies that you can walk in with a handful of drugs and walk in, put them on the counter and tell the officer at the desk that you need help, and they will connect you with help rather than take you to jail.
All right, we're just getting started this morning. It's our day-long conversation on the opioid crisis, 12 voices in 12 hours. Dr. Josh Lynch is here. He's an emergency room physician. He's also a member of the Erie County Opioid Task Force. And if you have any questions this morning or comments on this, you can text us at 3930.
Six 14 on WBEM. We continue 12 voices in 12 hours, looking at opioids in Western New York. Dr. Josh Lynch is our in-studio guest this hour. Josh, we've been talking a little bit about this opioid task force. It's kind of where you started on this issue before branching out to other things. You mentioned bringing all these people together. I'm wondering, what is the benefit? What have you seen as the result of bringing maybe someone like you, somebody in the medical field, together with someone from law enforcement, having police and doctors in the same room talking about this?
Right. So oftentimes we interact with law enforcement in the emergency department when they bring us somebody who's violent or combative or was in a car accident or something like that. But this is, this is a little bit of a kind of a unique relationship that we've developed that I don't necessarily think would have happened if we didn't kind of get together around this issue. So perfect example is a police officer stops somebody and for some reason they realize that, wow, this person is either in opiate withdrawal or has a problem that comes out in conversation. And typically those people would either get a ticket or get arrested. And I think now we're watching kind of the mentality of we can't really like arrest our way out of this problem, which thankfully our community is not doing. But so the kind of new approach to that would be, well, let's either hook them up with a treatment clinic or an addiction specialist, or occasionally they'll bring them to the emergency department and we kind of address their medical needs while working on getting them hooked up.
I'm assuming that might have been a difficult mentality to break, to be able to try and explain to, whether it's a police officer or a police chief that, hey, I know that maybe you would think and all your training would lead to, okay, we need to arrest this person, but that might not be the best idea.
I'll tell you, we have some pretty incredible law enforcement partners around here that are very open-minded. And actually, we had some law enforcement folks from Massachusetts come in who had been doing this really for a long time. And I would say a handful of the police departments around town had stepped right up and said, yep, we're in for sure. There was no convincing for some of them. Obviously, others had a little bit harder time kind of accepting this change.
I was going to say, was there any resistance at all?
There was. There was a little bit of resistance when we started to train law enforcement on carrying Narcan. Law enforcement's job is to keep us safe and a whole host of other things, and not necessarily to provide primary medical care. But now that most police officers carry defibrillators in their trunks, they've saved a lot of lives. And actually, now that the great majority of law enforcement agencies in Western New York carry Narcan, every single officer, they've also saved a lot of lives. And in a lot of parts of Western New York, the police get there before EMS does. So, We really wanted to equip all of them with Narcan, and it's worked very well so far.
I'm guessing when you said that there wasn't all that much resistance. You had a lot of people say, okay, we're on board, that they realized that what had been going on right. wasn't working. They were seeing maybe the same people keep popping up, and they didn't want to waste their time because that's kind of what it amounts to in the end.
Yeah, you know, they – a lot of people were very early on to say, yep, we're willing to help. But the real question is, well, then what do we do? And I think that's kind of where the task force functions the best is this guy's got this idea. This person has this idea. They don't know each other. They don't know how each other works. And the task force is really kind of a venue to get those people in the same room to say, hey, well, if you and I need each other to accomplish this goal, how do we do it?
I mean, it's a community brainstorming. Right,
right.
And I mean, it seems like it's been very successful.
It has, and you know, it's really spun off kind of a lot of other projects too that have started with discussions in this room, sometimes just casual in the hallway discussions about, hey, we should give this a try sometime, and you know, some of those things have come to fruition.
Well, we'll get some added perspective on this epidemic and exactly who this impacts. I think a lot of people are going to be surprised to hear who is impacted by this when they listen throughout the day. Our in-studio guest is Dr. Josh Lynch. More with him as 12 Voices in 12 Hours continue. Joining us in studio, one of the people on the front lines fighting the opioid epidemic. And when we say front lines, we mean it. In the ERs, looking at what happens when somebody comes in with an overdose. Josh, I think that's a question that's on a lot of people's minds. You know, we hear so much about Narcan. We hear so much about unfortunately, overdose deaths, but also people being revived. And we wonder what happens next. Can you take us into the ER when something like that happens?
Of course. So patients usually arrive a couple different ways. They don't always arrive how we think they would, you know, on an ambulance stretcher. Oftentimes, patients will come in with their family or kind of the most dramatic way that they arrive could be like unconscious in someone's back seat and they just drive up to the ER. So sometimes our care begins really not in the ER, but outside, like in the parking lot or in the underneath the ambulance overhang. We can really kind of start to like resuscitate or revive somebody out there. And typically that's with respiratory support and Narcan oftentimes. So we have the ability, most of the local hospitals have the ability to kind of take some medication outside and start doing that right outside. Oftentimes the patients can't necessarily wait to be brought all the way into the ER before we start working on them.
And then are they admitted or what happens next?
So when they come in and we kind of get them stabilized and get them awake and kind of get talking with them, most patients actually are not admitted unless they have taken a very long acting opioid medication that would require like many, many hours of observation. But typically we like to keep them for a couple hours in the emergency department, make sure that they're not going to go unconscious again. A big thing that most people don't realize is that Narcan doesn't usually last as long as a lot of opioids. So if somebody is reversed or revived on Narcan, they have the potential to go unconscious again. So that's why it's very important if somebody receives Narcan at home and you haven't called EMS, which happens. There's Narcan is out there all over the place, and sometimes friends will give it to their friend and then not call EMS. So that's very dangerous, and what people should know is if you give Narcan to somebody, the patient isn't going to get arrested. So that's kind of an arrangement with the law enforcement. So they'll come and help them. So don't be afraid to call 911 if you're giving somebody Narcan. You're not going to get them in trouble.
And that help continues after the Narcan or whatever immediate medical things need to happen at the hospital are done.
Right. So a lot has changed in how we not medically manage these patients in the emergency department, but what we do when they're ready to go home. Really what we used to do a few years ago, and this is really kind of embarrassing to say how we used to approach this, but really we would give them the patients a list of kind of clinics with phone numbers on there and say, hey, you know, here, call some of these clinics and get yourself an appointment. And that's really kind of how things were standardly done across the board. Unfortunately, you know, some of those numbers weren't great. Some of them didn't have any appointments. So I think we weren't really doing ourselves or our patients, which is the most important thing, any big favors. Thankfully, things are different now.
And so what is the procedure now when they leave?
So now in most of the Greater Buffalo emergency departments, you can, if you end up coming in for an overdose or in opiate withdrawal. We have a clinic network that we have built, very large. We have about 22 treatment addiction clinic offices scattered around Western New York that we partner with, and we have the ability to really let you leave the emergency department with an appointment. So you know where you're going to go, and you know what day the appointment is, and the office location is really your choice. And thankfully, we have partnered with a whole bunch of people that necessarily hadn't worked together. Another kind of product of the task force, and so we're able to really get patients linked out of the emergency department typically within about 48 hours with a clinic of their choosing.
You know, we have heard a lot of people, whether calling in, texting in to us, who have been critics ever since, you know, kind of this proliferation of of Narcan, where it's going out to the public. You're having classes teaching people how to use it. Obviously, in hospitals, it's been used for some time. People who say, "Well, isn't this just encouraging people that, you know, saying you can go too far with some of these drugs because there is this option readily available in most scenarios?" Is there any truth to that in what you see on a day-to-day basis?
You know, let me explain something about these people we're talking about. The vast majority of them are not using anymore for recreation. They're using because they have to. So they're, and what I mean by that is they're literally using just to stay out of withdrawal. So getting the fun effects of this is really not the case. So I think to the critics that think that Narcan is a safety net, that may be the case for a handful of people. But I will tell you, I meet a lot of people, and for the most part, that is not the case at all. They're not using and saying, "Oh, I can do whatever I want, go as far as I want to," because there's Narcan around. They're using really just to stay out of withdrawal. So when we see the patients in the emergency department, they are doing this just to function.
All right, we've got a lot more to get to. Dr. Josh Lynch is in studio, an emergency room physician. It's 12 Voices in 12 Hours on WBEN.
12 Voices in 12 Hours. This is a special community discussion on opioid prevention on News Radio 930 WBEN.
WBEN News Time 6:37. It's 12 Voices in 12 Hours, and we have in studio with us Dr. Josh Lynch, an emergency room physician, member of the Erie County Opioid Task Force. Dr. Lynch, let's get into demographics, if we can. Where we are with this problem right now, is it city problem, suburban? Is it more male than female, ages? How does it look?
So if there was one age kind of demographic that stands out as younger white males, is typically what we're seeing as far as statistics go. But what I will say is, in regards to whether this is a Buffalo, you know, city or a suburban problem, we're really kind of half and half. And I think half like in the greater Buffalo area and then half really kind of in the surrounding suburbs. And I think that number actually may be even shifting out of the city and really more back into the suburbs. So this certainly is not a city problem. And when we worked to create a group of addictions clinics, we wanted to make that would see patients right out of the emergency department. We wanted to make sure that we had a good kind of spacing between the city and everywhere else. So we have addiction specialists that are willing to see the patients right out of the ER, kind of scattered around the city itself, but then really kind of all around really the northern and southern suburbs.
You mentioned a younger white men is kind of a typical, maybe the majority of who you see. Is there a reason for that, and maybe how these addictions begin? Are you able to draw any lines there?
Yeah, I can't necessarily correlate the how things are beginning to who ends up, unfortunately, you know, overdosing more. But what I will say is that it's very important to be mindful of what type of prescriptions that you and your family members are getting. So if it's your children, particularly, being very careful about if they're leaving the doctor's office and they're about to get a prescription for 90 tablets of hydrocodone or something like that, which I think we're doing a lot better at. However, we're not perfect yet. So being mindful of, you know, what medications your family members or yourself are taking is really important.
How did we get to this point? You know, we didn't used to have opioid medication, right?
Opioid medication has been around a long time, but I think that a big reason is that patient satisfaction kind of companies that the hospitals and the doctor's offices work with had always rated pain as like a fifth vital sign. And I think this is where things have started. So that coupled with the fact that the drug companies were telling the doctors that these aren't addictive, right? It's kind of like the perfect scenario that someone's in with pain. You have a medication that you're under the impression is not addictive. You give them medication and they feel better, right? I mean, that's kind of why we're here, right? So that all started, right? And then somebody would come back and maybe say, hey, this really worked really well. Can I have another month of the prescription? Again, you're like, well, I want to help this person. And you give another month of the prescription. And back then, most of the doctors perhaps didn't know that this was super addictive and they're creating somebody that's going to be really addicted at the end of this. And just kind of more recent data has shown that even after a 5 or 7 day prescription of something like hydrocodone, a certain percentage of those patients will actually develop addictive tendencies even after less than a week. So it's super important for us to make sure that we're treating everybody with non-narcotic options when appropriate. And we do that oftentimes in the emergency department, and then it usually ends up working out just fine.
Dr. Josh Lynch is our in-studio guest this hour. We're talking about the prescribing, techniques or how opiates were prescribed for many years leading up to kind of a recent awakening. I don't know if you'd want to describe it as that, but... looking back now, is it surprising to see how slow medical professionals were to catch on to something that had been going around in high schools and with everybody for years and years? Because it wasn't that long ago when I was in high school, and I mean, you knew kids who got their wisdom teeth taken out would have a lot of these pills. It was not hard to find someone who had access to them, right, for one reason or another, and not just they had them from some, you know, shady techniques, but no, they had plenty of extra pills from their own doctors.
Right. I think that the balance between appropriately treating pain and not going over the line is hard, and it's actually still challenging. Not too long ago, I remember seeing prescriptions for 90 or 180 tablets of hydrocodone being written for, you know, certain orthopedic procedures or other like painful surgeries. And I think we've realized, especially with a lot of kind of new targeted education, that there are a lot of other kind of non-opioid regimens that work just as well. Or, you know, giving somebody 5 days of opioid medication in conjunction with something else, non-addictive or a non-controlled substance, seems to work well. But I don't think that really the effort was put forth years ago to kind of understand like the urgency that we have to figure out other non-narcotic ways to treat pain.
What are the alternatives to opioids? Are they names that we'd be familiar with?
Not particularly, but interestingly enough, even certain combinations of anti-inflammatory medications and Tylenol seem to work very well when they're dosed appropriately. So just things like this, like outside of the box, thinking of how do we avoid this? How can we treat pain patients better? We're using things like, you know, like IV lidocaine for kidney stone related pain in the hospital when we used to just give super high doses of narcotics, or IV anti-inflammatories instead of IV narcotics for, again, like kidney stone related pain. If anybody's ever had those, they're very uncomfortable. And it's kind of reassuring to know that other things other than very high doses of narcotic pain medication seem to work well. And thankfully, there's a lot more attention being paid to that stuff now.
A lot more attention being paid to that. Is that across the board? Are we there yet where we need to be to kind of look at this and say we won't continue to have this problem in the future?
Yeah, I think prescribing responsibly is really taking a good effect, you know, across the board. It's everyone's talking about it. I think that if somebody wrote a script for like 180 tablets, the red flags would be raised. Not only like regulatory flags, but even like amongst our colleagues, like, what are you doing? Like, why did you do that? So I think people are aware of it. People are talking about it. It's not necessarily something that, you know, is kept quiet anymore. And I think being, you know, doing the right thing and being responsible is what I hope most doctors would want to be.
And there's a registry, too, right? To monitor all of this.
So we can, most states now have a prescription monitoring program. Ours in New York is called iStop. And basically that tracks every controlled substance that anybody writes and puts it into a database. So the kind of the rule here is if you're writing a 5-day prescription for a controlled substance that you have to check that registry to make sure, that somebody's not getting a whole bunch of different prescriptions from a whole bunch of different doctors filled at a bunch of different pharmacies. And I'll tell you, it's some of the results that we find there are pretty alarming. So a recent person that I was taking care of ended up, we got talking about some painful condition. I was going to give like 3 days of something and ended up looking up this registry and actually printed it out. And turns out that this young lady was had been prescribed several hundred tablets of narcotic medication over the past like even month or two, and a bunch of fentanyl patches and a whole bunch of stuff like that. So I printed the papers out and went back in the room and sat down with her and showed her the paper. And I said, can you help me to understand like what's going on? Like, do you need help or is like, how did we get to this point? And I think that rather than kind of like judging her and getting angry or frustrated or upset, it turns out that, yep, she did actually have a problem and never really kind of looked at it on paper to realize like kind of what it was becoming. So that prescription monitoring program is helpful to make sure that you're not going to give somebody, a prescription that had a prescription yesterday. But also kind of in this young lady's case, like was fairly eye-opening for her.
12 Voices in 12 Hours will continue. Our in-studio guest, Josh Lynch, joining us until 7 o'clock this morning.
WBEN News Time, 647. In-studio with us for 12 Voices in 12 Hours, Dr. Josh Lynch, an emergency room physician, a member of the Erie County Opioid Task Force. And let's talk a little bit more about Narcan, if we can. Do you think more people should be equipped with it? Be able to administer it?
Yeah, I think it should be something that's fairly readily available. And as we saw not long ago, the Surgeon General offered kind of this advisory or advice that or memo or that this should be widely available. I mean, I think that it should be. It certainly has the potential to save lives, and it really doesn't have many negative consequences. So, kind of equipping the average person with this medication, especially if they have friends or family or coworkers or somebody that they know kind of is struggling, really I think is a good idea.
We were talking about the prescribing practices, kind of how they've changed over the past few years, and wondering your thoughts on the other side of that. We hear a lot from people who say, well, this is what helps me, these opiate medication, hydrocodone or something along similar lines. This is what helps me. I wonder what goes through your mind when you hear a patient say, this is what works for me, this is the only thing that can work, and this is what I need.
Right. So, of course, opioid medication takes pain away, but it's really our job as physicians to kind of quickly educate the patient on the fly about other options. And sometimes we're kind of on the defensive, right? When somebody comes in and has that approach with us, that we kind of back up a little bit and try to realize where they're coming from. Obviously, all this is done very quickly in our minds, and then try to figure out like a reasonable approach or a reasonable way to treat their pain appropriately. And oftentimes that ends up really being without opioids. And all these patients don't necessarily leave really like pissed off at us. I mean, we try to come up with a solution that works for both of us, that's responsible, but also, we'll treat their pain and let them leave comfortably.
Do you kind of feel like we're getting the upper hand on this right now? We're kind of turning the corner, or are we not there yet?
I do. I think we have a lot of work to do, and I think there are still a lot of people out there that are really struggling. Obviously, there are people out there that aren't going to win this battle, but I think that we're doing more than most communities are, as far as working together with really kind of every aspect and trying to hit every angle of this problem regionally. And I think that we've made a lot of good progress. We still have a lot of work to do, and I still think that we owe it to every single person out there that is still struggling or has passed away to work our hardest and not stop until this really is not a problem anymore.
Is there one place or one person in particular who you would recommend people who might think they have a problem, know somebody who has a problem, call first?
So the Erie County Opioid Epidemic Hotline is a good resource to start with. And so if you call that number, that's numbers for patients, family, friends, hospitals to call and really kind of get hooked up. And they can provide some resources to help you kind of get steered in the right direction. But talking to anybody is that really kind of the good first step, whether that's your primary doctor, whether that's the hotline who's open 24/7. But talking to somebody is I think, really the first place to start. There's not like a standard one place to go for everything, but I think the hotline is a good place to start.
All right. Dr. Lynch, we really appreciate the hour that we've spent with you and learned a lot. Dr. Josh Lynch, what hospitals do you operate out of?
I work for UBMD Emergency Medicine, so I work at Millard Suburban, DeGraff, ECMC, and Buffalo General.
All right. We really learned a lot in this hour, and it's just the kickoff to 12 Voices, 12 Hours. Dr. Josh Lynch.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.